You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says human contact is increasingly becoming a luxury good in today's society. We'll hear about the very different impacts technology is having on the rich and the poor. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Voters in two counties weighed in on the issue of nonpartisan redistricting on Tuesday's ballot. Husky Energy in Superior has announced plans for its refinery after last year's major explosion. And a Wisconsin woman is facing jail time in the Cayman Islands after a firearm was found in her luggage. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
Let's start with Election Day Tuesday. We've spent a lot of time talking about the Supreme Court. We've talked about school referenda. There were also these advisory referendums, Rob, on redistricting reform. What happened?
Sure. Well, you know, we've seen these before. There have been a lot of counties in the last few years who have, at one time or another, asked voters to weigh in on this question, and they always favor it by huge margins. And this was so on Tuesday as well. 77% of voters in La Crosse County said they are in favor of nonpartisan redistricting, 71% in Vernon County, and there was another one in the town of Newbold. So it's very, very popular. At least it is as a when it's as an abstraction to voters, right? It's like it's just sort of an advisory referendum, and just in the abstract, they say, yeah, we should, nonpartisan redistricting seems like a good idea.
And now I think we're at 42 out of Wisconsin's 72 counties have passed some kind of measure like this. Again, advisory, so it's not binding in any way.
Right. And I mean, that's kind of I don't want to be a downer to anyone in the WPR audience, but, I think it may not be a particularly highly salient issue for voters. That is, many people won't necessarily vote based on this issue. And so, effectively one way to look at these referendum votes is that it's kind of like a tension release valve for voters. And then legislators in power, which in Wisconsin means, Republicans in the legislature, can just sort of go on doing nothing about it. But it's also something that people feel passionately about, and it's also something that there's a lot of arguments that it would improve the way that voting districts are drawn. So these referenda at least are a tool for activists to say there's real support behind the idea.
One other outcome from Tuesday, Rob, Green Bay elected a new mayor after having the same mayor in place for, I think it was 16 years?
Yeah, 16 years. A guy named Jim Schmidt was the mayor, and he did not seek re-election. And so there was a big open primary. A bunch of candidates were running in the primary, and it was the general election on Tuesday. And the former Democratic state representative, Eric Genrich, is the next mayor of Green Bay.
And does this look like a big change in politics, or was this one of those mayoral elections that focused on, getting stuff done in the city?
Yeah, I mean, you got to talk about potholes, right? You got to talk about the roads in the city for sure. However, this race was, I think it's fair to say, it was unusually polarized. It became partisan because Genrich is a Democrat, had been elected as a Democrat for three terms in the state assembly. His opponent, Patrick Buckley, who is a business owner and a former police officer and a member of the Brown County Board, had the endorsement of the Brown County Republican Party. So for people who are inclined to see things through a Democrat-Republican lens, that was definitely available in this race.
I want to move on to some non-election stories now. Rob, a year ago this month, an explosion at the Husky Energy Refinery in Superior led to a partial evacuation of the city, lots of damage to the facility itself. Husky made an announcement about its future plans this week. What did you key in on what they're saying?
Yeah, so the Husky said two things. First, that they will be spending more than $400 million to rebuild the oil refinery and continue operations there after that explosion last year. And the second part of the announcement was that it will continue to use a chemical called hydrogen fluoride, this dangerous chemical compound that is used in making gasoline, which is what the Husky Energy does, And that was the cause of a lot of the evacuation of, like, a whole swath of Superior was evacuated after this explosion because there was hydrogen fluoride, this very toxic chemical, and the explosion had been caused by a hole in a valve of this tank. But the tank itself wasn't damaged, and that meant that, in effect, things could have been much worse in this explosion, where 36 people were injured, no one died, and people were able to come back to their houses relatively soon. So, it raised the question of whether they should be working with this chemical at this place. And the company this week said that there's really no other way to make gasoline. It's a necessary component. The CEO sort of downplayed the amount that is involved in the process. The headline is they're gonna go back to the way they used to do it.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin news. Here's an unusual story, Rob. A Madison woman is awaiting trial and a possible jail sentence in the Cayman Islands after stopping there as part of a cruise. What happened?
Yeah, this is kind of a weird one. Carol Ann McNeil Skorupan, a 68-year-old woman from Madison, went for a Caribbean cruise in February and decided to take her 25 caliber handgun and 6 rounds of ammunition with her. And she has a concealed carry permit in Wisconsin, and she apparently transported it legally in the airport on the U.S. side. But when she got to the Cayman Islands, they have different gun rules there, different laws. And she got word that there was a problem. She was arrested, charged with illegal possession of an unlicensed firearm, and she could face up to a 10-year prison sentence if the case goes to trial and she's convicted.
And she's not the first American to run into this issue in the Cayman Islands, it sounds like.
Yeah, I guess the Cayman Islands is actually unusually strict on their gun laws. There are these other cases. She is, according to the reporting, she is back in Wisconsin and needing to kind of like make some decisions about her future. One option, maybe her best option, at least a proposed option, is to skip the trial and just be a fugitive from justice in the Cayman Islands. But then they could possibly seek extradition. It could be a whole diplomatic incident, Rob.
Well, and I guess the lesson is check the State Department warnings before it, because the State Department says this pretty loud and clear: don't even bring a one round of ammunition into the Caymans.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, and you're leaving the country. It's not a sovereign nation, has its own laws. Yeah, it's definitely something to be aware of when you're traveling.
And finally, Rob, former Packers receiver Jordy Nelson announced his retirement recently. He spent one last season on the Oakland Raiders, but it sounds like he might make one more roster move before he's officially out of the league. Where is he going to go?
Jordy Nelson is in heavy negotiations for a one-day contract with the Green Bay Packers. That's an NFL Football League team from a sort of a part of northeastern Wisconsin.
Oh, we were just talking about the mayor of that town, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
I've heard of these Packers,
yeah.
Rob.
Yeah. So, the guy was drafted as a Packer in 2008. He spent his whole career as a Packer, except for this one season that who even wants to remember that he played in Oakland. So the hope is that if he can get a one-day contract, he will be able to retire as a Packer.
There was talk, there was some hope, I think, from fans that he would come back not just for a day, but, maybe come back with a contract for a season, reunite him with Aaron Rodgers. I think a lot of Packer fans would hope to see this. From what we could see now, I know you're not a sports reporter, Rob, but it doesn't seem like that's in the offing now.
He was released, and then he said in this radio interview that the Packers did not show an interest in signing him for real. He said that, if Aaron Rodgers personally asked him, he might return to football. And to be honest, I am the same. That's the same way. My time is with the NFL is mostly behind me, but if Aaron Rodgers were to approach me, I would have to consider it, I feel.
All right, Rob, we'll leave it there and watch for you lining up for the Packers then, it sounds like. Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He was with us to round up some of this week's top news from around the state. We are inviting your calls. Our topic this week, your favorite fictional place. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's define some terms now. Favorite can mean you think it's a pretty cool creation in that book, TV show, movie, play, I guess, comic book for that matter. You think it's really interesting. Favorite, it could mean a place you'd actually like to go or live in or visit. It could be very much not. Is it in my mind because, you know, Game of Thrones TV show is returning, a very richly realized place, whether you like the show or not. I've been watching news about a live action version of the animated show Cowboy Bebop, which has a pretty cool science fiction world, a great look to it as well. Want to hear yours now. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Chautauqua. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right. What do you want to share with us? Your favorite fictional place, John?
That would be Mayberry.
Mayberry from the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah, it's such a cool show. Innocent, pure, no filth and stuff. You know, just all character development.
Now, the memory I have is Andy in his police car pulling people over and rewarding them for their good driving by giving them a jar of Aunt B's jam or preserves, which it turns out aren't really that good. He's just trying to unload them.
Yeah, it was pickles that he was trying to get rid of.
Oh, it was the pickles. That was it. It wasn't preserves. It was the yucky pickles. All right. John, thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. We'll go down to Kathy with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
My favorite place is Mayberry as well.
Mayberry again?
Mayberry again. But for the reason that Andy and Barney were looking out for us, and Otis the town drunk, and Floyd will cut your hair, and, you know, Goober will take care of your car, Gomer Pyle. It was just, it's just such a nice thing, nice show to watch.
You find it reassuring that Barney Fife is looking out for you?
Well, his bullet's in his pocket, so he's not going to hurt anybody.
Fair. All right. Thank you so much, Kathy. We're taking your favorite fictional places. Ones I like, let's see. Oh, Chasm City from the science fiction series by Alistair Reynolds. Pretty cool. Don't know if I'd want to live there. Gets pretty weird, man. I'll share some more of mine as we go. Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez says, Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, Rivers of Chocolate, man, can't beat it. Yeah, it worked out really well for most of the kids who went through there. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Fitchburg. Jim, hello.
Hello. I want to go to see the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. Okay. A lot of cool stuff in Oz. Like, what do you want to see there? Is it the wizard in particular or the landscape or what landmarks do you want to see in Oz, Jim?
All of it in particular, especially those witches that fly around.
All right. Bad news for you, Jim. They didn't end well. Thank you so much for that call, Jim. That is a pretty good one, though. I don't know. It can be dangerous, though, if you watch the show The Magicians or read the books it's based on. Visiting your cherished childhood fantasy land doesn't always work out as well as you might hope. Back to your calls now. Vern is with us in Boyd. Vern, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've always dreamt of being in a space station, a small one, with a group of people that are just like us, that don't look like, gross idiots or whatever you want to call them, but look like us and are about 50 to 100 years advanced from us, where we could ask them any question we wanted to so we would know what the world's going to be like in the future.
All right, Vern, I'm looking forward to your novel, man. This sounds pretty good. Thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. There's a lot of great space stations in the world of fiction. Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5, not at all coincidentally, came out around the same time with life on a space station packed with all sorts of different alien species. Thanks for the call, Vern, at 800-642-1234. Will joins us now in Eau Claire. Will, hello.
Hey, Rob. Great idea. This is so much fun.
Oh, thanks,
fun.
Man.
Yeah. When I was a kid growing up in South Bend, Indiana, I was obsessed, and I still am, with scuba diving. I've been a diver for 60 years now, and my favorite show, I watched it just about every day when I came home from school, was Sea Hunt with Lloyd Bridges.
Oh.
Young Lloyd Bridges playing Mike Nelson. So my favorite place would be anywhere underwater where Mike Nelson was always swimming around doing good. And it was just a kick to watch. So thank you.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Will, thanks so much for your call at 800-642-1234. Your favorite fictional place from book, movie, TV show, comic book, you name it. Whether you want to go there or not, call in at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Jim is on the line in New Franklin. Jim, hi. What place do you want to share with us?
Well, it's obvious it's got to be Gilligan's Island.
Okay, why Gilligan's Island? Just to get away from it all?
Get away from it all. He's stranded on an island with a bunch of people. You can come and be my little buddy.
Jim, I'll put an asterisk on there. I'm only going if the professor is there, because he can build a radio out of coconuts.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Jim. I don't know. I mean, Tropical Island, you could do worse than that. They found a lot of food to eat, built the shelter. I don't know. And they got to meet the Harlem Globetrotters when they came back on return to Gilligan's Island. So that's pretty cool. Peter joins us now in Washburn. Peter, take us somewhere.
Shangri-La from the book Far Horizons.
Okay, tell us more. I mean, I've heard of Shangri-La. I'm not familiar with the book. Set the scene for us, Peter.
Well, it's a lost valley somewhere in supposedly in the Himalayas that everyone gets along and, you know, there's peace and love, that type of thing.
Well, that sounds nice. And so, you'd want to actually go there, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to live there.
All right. Peter, thank you so much. See, people have all these places they want to go. I have a lot of, like, favorite creations. But then you ask me, do you want to be there? No. Like, a lot of times they're really stabby. So maybe that says something about me. I don't know. Back to your calls. Shiloh is with us from Milwaukee. Shiloh, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What place do you want to share with us?
I want to go to Corellia. I want to go see where Han Solo grew up. I bet you they have great parties out here.
They would, and you could see how the Corellian cruisers are made in Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And would you want to do some smuggling yourself, Shiloh?
Oh, for sure. Why not?
Okay. Thanks so much. Yeah, where in the Star Wars universe would I want to go? I don't like Ewoks, so that takes out the forest moon of Endor. Coruscant, no. I'll have to get back to you on a place in Star Wars I'd want to go. But we'll go back to calls right now. Laura takes us to Menominee. Laura, hello.
Yeah, I was thinking a really cool place to go would be Doctor Who's telephone booth.
Oh, yeah. The TARDIS.
Yeah, you go anywhere, anytime. Be pretty cool.
Yeah, but the problem was, at least the section that I watched when I was a kid, you couldn't actually control where and when it went, right? It took you where you where it wanted to go.
Oh, that would be fun, too. Who knows?
All right. Laura, thank you so much. It was way bigger on the inside than the outside. It went on forever, even though it looked pretty small, the size of a telephone booth. It's a police box. That was a British thing. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. You're sharing your favorite fictional places. Drea is with us in Middleton. Drea, hello.
Hi. Referencing back to the Brits, the culture universe from the culture novels by Ian Banks would be awesome to go to. They've moved beyond the need for money. They have gene modification down so nobody is sick, and the AIs have become these benevolent, kind of omniscient caretakers of humanity. It's pretty great.
And there's one about a guy who plays games, right? Which sounded pretty cool to me, the player
of
games.
Yeah, that's creepy. Well, because they go and they interact with not quite as advanced societies that are still working through their problems and their hierarchies, and that's where the stories come in.
There's still conflict.
But the culture universe itself is pretty great. Yeah.
Fantastic, Drea. The culture worlds in the Ian Banks novels. Thanks a lot. We'll go now to Lynn in Hustisford. Lynn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Three Pines.
Three Pines. What's that from?
It is from Louise Penny's books. She writes mystery stories, and they take Three Pines is in Quebec near Montreal, and it's a little village that you can only find when you need it.
Oh, kind of a Brigadoon sort of scenario, or?
In a sense, except that there's a lot of mayhem and murders.
Yeah, that's the problem with wanting to be in a place in a mystery series. People, I don't know, the death rate seems suspiciously high. Thank you, Lynn. Time for another call or two. Helen is with us in Madison. Helen, hi.
Hi there. I would want to go to the Shire because I've always wanted to be a hobbit. So
that's Shire is the hobbit homeworld in the Tolkien novels. I mean, you like that idea of it seemed very cozy. That was the key there.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, indeed. That seems like a very lovely place to live amongst the greenery of it all and everything else.
And a lot of meals per day. The meals per day rate is pretty good for hobbits.
Indeed, yeah. I like that one, too.
All right, Helen, thank you so much. Thanks to everybody who called in and everybody still on the line. Sorry we couldn't get to you. You can keep sharing your favorite fictional places. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page. House Democrats flexed their oversight muscles this week. Three House committees moved to obtain President Trump's tax returns, a decade of his financial records, and prepared to issue a subpoena for the full, unredacted Mueller report. All three are moves that highlight Democrats' aggressive strategy when it comes to congressional oversight of the Trump administration, a role Representative Elijah Cummings, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, described like this.
Every one of us in this room has a duty to serve as an independent check on the executive branch. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in search of the truth.
Molly Reynolds is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She studies Congress and is part of a project tracking House oversight of the Trump administration. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into some of the particular oversight efforts, can you talk about the role of Congress when it comes to overseeing the actions of the executive branch?
Sure. So oversight of the executive branch is one of Congress's fundamental responsibilities. Congress has a very broad jurisdiction in terms of what it can investigate and what it can look into. It's a central part of our separation of powers system that Congress keeps an eye on what the executive branch is doing. It has lots of different tools available to it to do this, everything from holding hearings to sending letters to using the power of the purse. You know, Congress is the one who's responsible for passing bills that give the executive branch money to spend, and it can use the development of those bills and the process of writing language into them to really put a check on what the executive branch is doing.
Big picture, do we tend to see a lot more oversight when one party controls a branch of Congress and a different party controls the White House?
Absolutely. If we look back through history, we certainly see that under what we call divided party control, when one party is in control of Congress and the other, or at least one chamber of Congress, as we see right now, and the other party controls the White House, that is a recipe for more oversight than we see under unified party control when the same party is in power.
We've seen accusations from Democrats that Republicans, let's focus on the House here because that's what just changed, that Republicans in the House didn't do enough oversight when it came to the Trump administration. Now Republicans are accusing the Democrats of too much oversight activity. I think it's fair to say now that they have control. Is there any merit to either of those accusations?
So first of all, I'd say that the idea that each party is accusing the other party of being too aggressive or not aggressive enough, that's not a particularly new phenomenon. If we go back through periods of divided party control and switches in partisan control, certainly back to the 1990s, we've seen both parties leveling these kinds of allegations against one another. I do think that there, if we look at some of the things that happened during the first 2 years of the Trump administration that went uninvestigated by the House when it was under Republican control, I do think there are some things that Democrats are picking up now that probably should have been looked at during those first 2 years, particularly in terms of sort of allegations of ethical misconduct by folks in the executive branch, but also in terms of policy implementation. And that's a really important thing to remember when we think about oversight, that we're not just talking about kind of what President Trump or people close to President Trump have done, but also what are the choices that executive branch departments have made about how to implement policy in the Trump administration?
Yeah, is there a piece of oversight that isn't one of the banner headline issues I mentioned in the introduction there? Is there something that should be on our radar that we're maybe not looking at enough?
Sure. Sure. So, I mean, I would certainly say that what's getting the big flashy headlines in the first couple of months of the year are the things that are targeted at President Trump himself. So things like, you know, we saw not long ago the House Judiciary Committee put forward 81 different document requests to people in the White House, connected to the White House. But there's also a lot of really important other work going on. Here I'm thinking about, you know, investigative work related to the family separation crisis along the southwestern border. I'm thinking about work that's being done to investigate the choices made around the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And then things like we just saw this week, the House Transportation Committee start to look into did the FAA and the play any role in what has happened with Boeing and the certification of those aircraft. So there's a lot of real policy work going on as well, in addition to the work that is getting a lot of the headlines that has to do with President Trump himself.
Talking to Molly Reynolds with the Brookings Institution, looking at Congress and the president, recent oversight efforts from Democrats, especially in the House when it comes to the Trump administration. Well, I do want to touch on some of those big headline issues, Molly, including Democrats trying to get access to President Trump's long controversial tax returns. What's going on there?
Sure. So we saw this week the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richie Neal of Massachusetts, ask for Trump's tax returns. There's a provision of federal law that allows him to do that. We saw immediately some signals from the White House that they are reluctant to comply with that request from the Ways and Means Committee. So we expect that this dispute is headed for the courts. And one thing that's really important to remember about congressional oversight, the tax returns and other instances where the executive branch is reluctant to comply, is that the efforts to get information out of the executive branch can end up in the courts, and that work can be really slow going, that it can take quite a long time to litigate, say, compliance with a congressional subpoena or other issues related to Congress trying to get information out of the executive branch. And so I suspect that what we saw this week from the Ways and Means Committee is just the first step in what's likely to be a relatively long, protracted conflict about getting the tax returns.
Are there any precedents out there in the courts when it comes to the Congress says, give us this information about the president, and the White House says no?
So we have a number of high-profile court cases that have been litigated by White Houses of both parties trying to resist requests from Congress for information. Two relatively recent high-profile cases were one involving the George W. Bush administration and an effort to get information and to compel testimony related to the firing of several U.S. attorneys in the mid-2000s. We saw, and then in the Obama administration, we also saw a protracted legal fight between Congress and the White House related to the Justice Department and Attorney General Holder and the Fast and the Furious operation. And in both of those cases, again, it took quite a while for the case to work its way through the courts. And so I think one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we're having this conversation in April 2019, and we could go well into 2020 without ultimate resolution on some of these disputes between Congress and the president about information.
So a dispute between the president and Congress could outlive, say, a president's term in office.
Absolutely. And then we, you know, when we, if there's a partisan change after, as a result of an election, we can see the Justice Department and the new administration maybe take a different stance towards that case. But again, it's important to remember that these sorts of things, when both sides decide to dig in their heels, both the president and Congress, really can take a while to get resolved.
We're talking to Molly Reynolds with the Brookings Institution. She's with us to talk about House Democrats and their oversight efforts for President Trump and the executive branch. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Big picture, what do you think about how Democrats are overseeing the president? Do you think their investigations are justified? When Republicans controlled the House, what did you think of their approach to oversight? And on particular issues, should the president be compelled to release his tax returns? Should the White House release the full Mueller report, unredacted or lightly redacted? What do you want to see happen in those two cases? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about congressional oversight, the politics surrounding it, and its role in our constitutional system. Molly Reynolds is with us from the Brookings Institution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what looks to be a growing number of clashes between Democrats in the U.S. House and President Trump and his White House? Do you think the president should release his tax returns? Should Democrats in Congress try to make him do that? How about the Mueller report? Do you think we should see the whole thing, or at least members of Congress should see the whole thing? Should Congress be pursuing that? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Molly, before we go to our callers, let's talk about the Mueller report. We had this summary from Attorney General William Barr. There are news reports kind of at second hands now saying that some Mueller investigators think that didn't properly represent what they said. What is the latest on efforts in Congress to see the whole thing?
Yeah, so I think folks in Congress and the House are still trying to figure out exactly what strategy makes the most sense going forward to try and get that information. And I do expect that it will be a major focus of some of the work of the relevant House committees. We'll see if, for example, they have Attorney General Barr come to testify to talk about, you know, his decision-making process. And so because that's such a high-profile thing that the administration has been working on, I do think that folks in the House will be paying quite a lot of attention to it. We did have a deadline this week that House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler had given for Barr to turn over the report that I believe appears to have come and gone. And so we will, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what the next steps are in that process.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Galena. Steve, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Hey, I just wanted to comment and say, guys, I'm an old man, and I've been watching this for the last 20 or so years just fight with each other, and that's what it seems to be, just harassment back and forth. I'm an independent voter. I vote for who I think is right. But I'm just curious, why can't Congress come together and pull to the middle of the road and just try to make our country really strong, put us back out in front, get us out in front economically again, and really focus on the overall issues instead of just being so divided.
Steve, thanks for the call. So Steve, and Steve's not alone, seeing this as kind of petty bickering, I think, Molly, that's distracting from more important stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so while the caller may be an independent voter, we actually have relatively few independent voters. Most people vote pretty reliably for one party or the other, which gives members of Congress, particularly those from safe congressional districts, an incentive to really kind of dig in and not necessarily cooperate with the other side. And so there are many, many Americans who are frustrated with that trend, but it's really the result of kind of broader forces in our politics and not necessarily the individual choices that members of Congress are making.
Steve, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Marina in Pleasant Prairie. Hello, Marina.
Yes, hello. Listen, I too am an independent, so we must be unicorns. and but we're still out there. We drive everybody. Listen, regarding the Mueller report, open it all. Barr screwed it up. He might as well put a struck a match and just lit it to oil well. Boom. Now, number two. Hey, listen. I'm military. I'm Army, okay? When you serve, you put that uniform on, You're not a Republican. You're not a Democrat. You're not a Green. You're not this or that. You're an American. And you fight and defend one thing. And, it, and what is, what the, how I see this abomination working out is growing up was during the Cold War, right? I was kid. And can you imagine this crap going on then? Okay. When we had Big Mother Russia, USSR.
Marina, thanks a lot for the call. Are things worse now, Molly, than they were, as Marina was saying, maybe in the Cold War era when it comes to bickering between parties and branches of government?
Sure. So one thing that's happened since the Cold War era, so if we think going back to the early 1980s, is that the parties have gotten farther apart. They've gotten more polarized. There's more distance between Democrats and Republicans. We used to, you know, see some overlap in the House, that there were some Republicans who might have been a little bit more liberal than some Democrats, and that's really changed. And so we do have these two parties with a big kind of difference between them. And that, again, has really reduced the incentives for the parties to cooperate with one another and increased the incentives for them to engage in the kind of behavior that a lot of Americans find frustrating and might call bickering.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Molly Reynolds from the Brookings Institution about congressional oversight efforts. House Democrats doing a lot, looking at much of what the presidential administration is doing, trying to get tax returns, the Mueller report released, and more. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Molly, I've heard from some people who study this kind of stuff that one of the big stories isn't just the rising partisanship, but also a change in the balance of power, more power, maybe too much power going to the executive branch relative to Congress. What do you think?
Yeah, so we certainly, going back to the 70s, have seen Congress give more and more power to the executive branch. In some cases, because Congress doesn't want to have to make kind of the hard, detail-oriented choices about how to actually implement policy. So they have a preference for writing vaguer laws that leave much more room for the executive branch to fill in the details. And one big challenge there is that once you've given power over to the executive branch isn't really interested in giving it up. So Congress has to work really hard to take it back if it wants to. And that trend has been occurring at the same time as this trend in polarization that we've been talking about. So when one party in Congress has a president of their party in the White House, you know, they're also not necessarily interested in trying to rein in a president of the same party. They want to, you know, give that president more latitude to do things that members of that party like. So we have seen these kind of two trends happening at the same time, which has really set up Congress at a disadvantage in terms of trying to rein in and check the executive branch.
Is this is it fair to say this is a bipartisan trend? Presidents of either party are happy to get more authority and reluctant to give it up?
I would say it is. And, you know, certainly if we go back to the 1970s, we've seen presidents of both parties, you know, try to expand the influence of the White House. And congressional majorities of both parties struggle mightily in certain situations to try to get some of it back.
Let's dig, Molly, into the tools in Congress's toolkit. You mentioned subpoenas earlier. House committees, Senate committees, for that matter, can do that. What is the weight of a congressional subpoena? What does it mean when they issue one?
Right. So when a congressional committee issues a subpoena, either to compel a witness to appear before them or to compel the production of information, it is, you know, like a subpoena in a court of law. It's it has a legal force and effect. What can be difficult, however, is actually enforcing compliance with the subpoena. And often, particularly when the target of the subpoena is in the executive branch, Congress ends up in litigation to try and enforce that subpoena. A subpoena can be a useful tool. It can be really useful for making a particular person show up to testify. It doesn't really matter in terms of for the purposes of making a witness answer particular questions. Another thing that's worth remembering about subpoenas is that oftentimes, you know, the power of the subpoena isn't necessarily in its actual issuance and its actual you know, being served to someone. It's the threat of the subpoena that often will open up negotiations with someone in the executive branch or someone in the private sector who might be subject to congressional oversight. Something else that we saw this week that is worth noting about subpoenas is that there are some situations where particularly a private company might say that in order to actually cooperate because of the kind of state of the law on particular issues, that they might actually welcome a subpoena in order to compel them to cooperate. So we've seen reporting on that in terms of some financial companies who have been asked for information about President Trump and his financial record. So it'll be sort of interesting to see where that goes as well.
Less than a minute left, Molly. What else are you looking for in the next couple of weeks? What shoe are you waiting for to drop next?
So I'll certainly be watching the progress on Congress's efforts to get its hands on the Mueller report. And then I'll also just be paying attention to the first steps in this fight over the tax returns. You know, where exactly does that go? And then lastly, just keeping an eye on these other substantive policy issues that Congress is also trying to oversee, things like the family separation crisis and other kinds of immigration policy in the next couple of weeks and months.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Reynolds, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. She was with us today to talk about how House Democrats are approaching their oversight role of the Trump administration and more generally about how congressional oversight of the executive branch works. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, small towns around the state face a lot of challenges, many of them economic challenges. A guest tells us what it can take to rebuild a working economy in those communities. A lot of state laws are written by lobbyists or cribbed from model legislation crafted by national groups. An investigative reporter tells us how that's playing out here in Wisconsin. And a program in the Fox Cities is trying to help prevent racist harassment by teaching bystanders how to intervene. One of the trainers joins the show to tell us how that works. That, plus we'll take a look at some of the top news stories of the day and preview a new documentary on Wisconsin Public Television on rural health concerns. That's coming up Monday on Central Time.